morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you back to day two of the Direct-to-Consumer Genetic Testing Cross Academies workshop. Today you will notice that there are no lights in the room. We are not being recorded, so everybody can say what they really think. And if you don't want to know what we really think, then you should know that C-SPAN 2 has been playing yesterday's session since 2:30 this morning. And all of you are welcomed to the national limelight, and all of us wish we had put on makeup, dressed a little differently, lost 30 pounds, and that's over. We're back to business today. So today we have a half day, or just over a half day, with a number of very wonderful sessions and continuation of the discussions yesterday, at the end of which we hope to have some time to discuss where this area and this field and these questions should be going in the future. I want to park that thought so that everybody has a chance to think about it before we get to the end of the session today, so that we do have a chance to hear from you, the panelists, the people around the table, as well as the audience. We would welcome your suggestions as to how to proceed, what the areas of greatest opportunity, need, and impact would be. So this morning, Courtney Harper is going to lead us off with a discussion of the FDA and regulation of direct-to-consumer genetic testing. Thank you for being with us, Courtney.
Thank you, Barbara. Can you all hear me? So I'm Courtney Harper, and I am from the Food and Drug Administration, and I work in the Office of In Vitro Diagnostic Devices, and we are the office that regulates diagnostic tests in the United States, so basically laboratory tests. So FDA actually is responsible for regulating a lot of things. We have, you know, food, safety, and applied nutrition, so when you hear about the spinach and the peanuts and all of that, that would be that center. There's certainly the Center for Drug Evaluation. These would be the people who obviously approve drugs in the United States. Biologics does vaccines and biologic materials, organ transplants, blood banks. We also have a Center for Veterinary Medicine. I don't know if you knew that the Food and Drug Administration actually regulates pet food and pet medicines and also pet diagnostics. And we also have what's called the Office of Regulatory Affairs, which is the FDA that's all around the country, the people going out and doing food, drug, device inspections, et cetera. But I actually work in the Center for Devices and Radiological Health, so we actually regulate all medical devices in the U.S. And I added another slide. I don't know if any of you are aware, we actually just recently got a new center that's forming to regulate tobacco. But today I'm going to talk to you about devices. And medical devices are a pretty broad range of things. They can be tongue depressors, they can be toothbrushes. Microwaves are actually regulated by FDA and the Center for Devices because of the radiation part of their function. So it's pretty broad. And actually, you know, FDA was given the authority to regulate in the first place in 1904. And then the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is the law that we work under. So that's what it gives FDA the authority to regulate what they regulate. And the medical devices actually weren't regulated by the FDA until 1976. I'm not sure if some of you are aware of that. But basically, that put in place the parameters by which medical devices are evaluated. And one thing that's a little bit different between medical devices and drugs is that the range of medical devices that I mentioned is very different from drugs. So if you have a drug, basically, there are certainly different types of drugs for different uses and different risks. But generally, if you have a drug, you have to do the same sorts of, you know, two prospective studies to get on the market, and there's a fairly high bar for those things. If you have a tongue depressor, obviously FDA isn't going to require that you do two prospective studies to determine whether that device can, you know, depress the tongue. But if you have an artificial heart, FDA may require that you do robust clinical studies to determine that device is safe and effective for use. So the provisions of the medical device laws actually put in place a little bit of a different regulatory paradigm than are used for drugs. Some of them are similar, though. They do provide for what we call good manufacturing practices. And this means that any medical device that's manufactured today should be the same as one that's manufactured next month or next year. So it's basically manufacturing controls to assure ongoing quality. It also puts in place requirements for post-market reporting and surveillance. So anytime someone's injured by a medical device, that has to be reported to the company and often also reported to the FDA. Anytime there's a death that results from a medical device, that has to be reported to FDA so that FDA can at least try and make sure that there's somebody overseeing trends and injuries and make sure that devices that have been cleared or approved for use in the United States continue to be safe and effective for their use. But I'd say the main difference on regulation of devices from things like drugs is actually regulation by intended use. So medical devices are regulated by risk and in a different fashion according to risk. So those tongue depressors I mentioned don't need to come to FDA before they go on the market. They may just have to meet tongue depressor standards, whereas the heart valves and artificial hearts must come in for approval prior to going on the market and provide data for safe and effective use. So in vitro diagnostic devices is what our office regulates, and they actually have their own regulation and their own definition. And I've written it up here. I won't read it, but it's basically a very broad definition. So the FDA definition of a diagnostic test includes things like risk prediction, includes things like an assessment of prognosis. It includes anything intended to cure, mitigate, treat, or prevent disease. And it also includes those things that actually are used in the collection, preparation, and examination of specimens. So it includes collection devices, it includes the actual tests and the reagents themselves, and it includes the instruments that are used to evaluate them. So that's one thing that I think we see that people are confused sometimes. They say, well, my test is not a diagnostic test because we don't actually make a standalone diagnosis. From FDA's point of view, even an adjunctive test is actually qualifies as a medical device. We regulate things like calcium tests and phosphorus tests, which aren't generally used as standalone tests. They're used as among a battery of tests, but they're still regulated. These tests are often used in clinical laboratories. Many of them are prescription-type tests. But we also regulate tests for use in other settings, so tests for use at the bedside, point of care in hospitals or doctor's offices. And we also regulate tests that are used over-the-counter, pregnancy tests, over-the-counter drugs of abuse tests, et cetera. So when we look at tests, what do we look at? We're actually concerned that, especially for molecular diagnostic tests, but really for any test, that the people who are using them, whether it be a healthcare professional or a lay consumer, are actually aware of the value of the test and the limitations of the test. So of course we know that not all tests are 100% sensitive and specific, and that's okay as long as the sort of value of the test is known. If the test is a valuable test, then FDA might clear or approve it, or it might be suitable for use in patients. But really the doctor needs to understand, you know, how can I interpret that information and how can I use that in my decision making. So in order to get to that point, FDA actually looks at several things. At the sort of bar for FDA approval for tests is what we call safety and effectiveness. And when you're talking about a diagnostic test, that safety and effectiveness is often a little bit indirect. So whereas safety is actually really very much linked to effectiveness, which isn't the case for all medical devices, because the safety is really related to an incorrect result, so a false positive or false negative, perhaps that's not expected. And in that case, you might have an incorrect decision being made. Maybe somebody's given a drug that's not correct for them, or maybe somebody's not given treatment when they need it. So we assess the risk of a test on that basis. And then once we have a test classified by risk, we know sort of what the level of regulation should be, whether that test should be exempt from FDA regulation. So there's a class of tests that we believe are so low risk that they actually don't even need to come to FDA. And FDA actually would say, okay, you need to have post-market surveillance and you need to have good manufacturing practices, but you actually don't need to come for pre-market clearance or approval. Most diagnostic tests are what we would call a sort of a moderate risk. And in those tests, they come in for what we call clearance. That's sort of a medium bar. You will have to provide data, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but you don't get a pre-market inspection of your facilities, although you do need to meet the same types of requirements. And you are able to modify your test with a little bit more freedom than a high-risk test. High-risk tests have the highest bar. It's very much more similar to drug approval in that there's a pre-market inspection and an assessment of data where the bar is actually safety and effectiveness. So when we have a test that comes into FDA for pre-market clearance or pre-market approval, we have to look at safety and effectiveness. And effectiveness is twofold. It's analytical for IVDs, and it's also clinical. So say we were to get a new glucose meter for over-the-counter use. We would actually look very closely at its analytical performance. How reproducible is the result? And also, how accurate is that result? And we would look at accuracy probably compared to some sort of a gold standard methodology for measuring glucose. What we wouldn't do for that test, however, is require that they prove to us by providing new scientific data that monitoring a person's blood glucose is useful, because that's very well established in the medical community. So people already know diabetics should monitor their blood glucose in order to treat their diabetes. However, if you have a new type of test or a test that's not very well established, then FDA will ask for data on clinical performance. And that data is to establish that the test can actually do what you're claiming it can do, so what we call the intended use. So if you have a genetic test and you're claiming that it can provide an estimate of a patient's one-year risk of mortality from cardiovascular disease, then you would have to actually provide data that demonstrates that your device can predict basically one-year mortality, risk of one-year mortality for cardiovascular disease. So it's basically you get to pick the claim, and then you get to provide the data. So clinical data is required for medical devices such as IVDs. The third basic thing that we require is labeling. We have actually, in vitro diagnostics have their own labeling regulations, and it provides for a clear description of the test's intended use, what you're claiming that it can do, a description of the test itself and how it's performed, and then a description of the performance data for that test, both analytical and clinical, where required. And we have a mandate for what we call adequate instructions for use, and that means basically you should tell the doctor or the user everything they need to know to be able to interpret that test correctly, including directions for use, warning, limitations, interpretation information, et cetera. When we have clinical performance, often, you know, analytical performance, of course, have their own challenges, but they're fairly well understood. You need to, you know, show that your test can analytically measure what you're saying it can. But clinical performance, especially for new analytes, is really the challenge. How can I prove clinically that my test does what I think it does? And a lot of the challenges we're seeing with new markers are that they actually really do need some clinical data to support their use. So especially in this area of direct-to-consumer tests, we're often seeing the use of a lot of genome-wide association studies. People go into the literature and they'll say, well, this gene was associated with this phenotype, and it was also associated a little bit in this other paper, so we think maybe we can conclude that this gene is associated. I think FDA would generally believe that genome-wide association studies are more of an exploratory type of study, and that once you actually have a hypothesis, FDA would probably want some sort of an independent evaluation of that association in an independent data set. So this can sometimes be retrospective. So a lot of times people will develop a new signature or a hypothesis in one type of study set or one set of data, and they may actually see if it holds up in a separate independent set of data. One of the challenges there is whether or not there are enough data sets for you to be able to do that, or whether there is enough information about the test for someone to be able to do that. So I think that's one of the challenges people are seeing are there samples available for me? Or if not, can I afford to do a clinical study myself? Or is my company really interested in doing that type of clinical study? We also believe that the validation testing should be done in the intended use population. If an association is seen in people, you know, who have cardiovascular disease already, then maybe that test, it may not be useful in people for screening for cardiovascular disease, for example. So you really have to think about how the test will be used, and the data supporting the clinical use of that test needs to actually reflect that use. And, you know, as I said, the right study can really be challenging there. So if you're going to bring in an IVD to FDA for over-the-counter use, which would be something sold directly to consumers without a prescription, there are some other requirements. So that glucose meter I mentioned, for example, they come in and they show us that somebody can take those instructions, They can collect a sample, they can run a test, and then they know what to do with that result at the end of the day just using the instructions, because they're going to go to Walmart and they're going to buy that meter and they're going to be using it without perhaps their doctor showing them how. And studies are actually done to show that they can do this. And we also look to see whether these tests are actually as accurate when used by lay users as others. We do have over-the-counter tests that we regulate where the test is actually performed in a centralized laboratory, but the over-the-counter portion is really a collection kit. So that kit is actually mailed to a consumer. They may take some blood in a capillary tube, or they may provide a saliva sample, mail it back to the company. And then what we're looking at in those cases is, can they understand the results of the test when they get them back? So really, we look at human factors. We look at the labeling. We look at how it's described. We look at the information that's provided and say, is this test something that's appropriate for use directly to consumers? And I think that would apply to our opinion of any type of genetic test that might be offered over the counter as well. So I'm going to transition a little bit over into policy from sort of science and process. Many of you are probably aware that getting a test onto the market in the United States currently, there's two actual methods for doing so. So one method that sort of is the one I've been talking about is where a test kit manufacturer, say Siemens or Roche or Abbott or some other new company, manufactures a test. And they make it in a lab, and then they make it into a kit. And the intention is actually to sell it out to labs across the country. And the laboratory then performs the test according to the instructions for use. Those tests actually come to FDA for pre-market clearance or approval before they're sent out to these laboratories and they get cleared or approved. And then, you know, the laboratories will use it for the patient. The other way that tests are currently offered is what we call laboratory-developed tests. And that's where you have a laboratory who is regulated as a high-complexity laboratory under CLIA. So CMS would regulate the laboratory processes and personnel. And then the laboratory creates a test, the test is made, and then it's offered to consumers without FDA review. And this is done under FDA enforcement discretion. So laboratory-developed tests are actually medical devices under the Federal Food and Drug and Cosmetic Act, but FDA has historically provided enforcement discretion for these tests. Sure. I'm going to go into a little more detail in a minute here, but more slowly, laboratory-developed tests are medical devices under FDA's jurisdiction, but historically, FDA has what we call applied enforcement discretion. That is, we have not enforced the law on those tests that would require them to come in for pre-market clearance or approval and do all those post-market and manufacturing requirements. Why there was enforcement discretion? I wasn't going to, but I can do that in a second.
Can you actually go back to the slide?
Sure.
So, very simple about it. The target for FDA on the left side is
the kidney. We regulate the test, yes.
I'm sorry. So, on the left side of the slide, what you regulate is the kit in the mailbox.
We regulate the diagnostic test, yes.
Right. And on the right side of the slide.
Anything else required with it. So sometimes they're labeled for things that aren't in the kit, but
right. Okay.
It's the whole test.
And on the right side of the slide, that's the lab that is essentially accredited, regulated, reviewed.
In the scenario on this slide, CLIA regulates the laboratory, and at this point, no one regulates the test.
Right. So you don't look at the bottles in the middle, as it were. You don't look
right.
at those things in the middle. But you could.
FDA does have some regulation over here right now that we are doing, and that would be in the realm of regulating some of the reagents and equipment that are used in laboratories. So
okay.
Instruments that are sold to laboratories might be exempt from FDA clearance or approval requirements, but they're actually FDA-regulated products, and ASRs are FDA-regulated
products. I think Dave and I have the same question. So you don't actually, the stuff that comes out of the lab, you could look at.
Right.
But you don't.
Correct.
So it defaults to the quality of the lab itself.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And
I think what David was really asking is the decision not to exercise.
Right.
Right. And I didn't add a slide here, but I will get to that point in a second. I will address that. So what is a lab developed test? A lab developed test is a test that is developed by a single lab for use only in that lab. And so when we say developed, we mean designed, manufactured, assembled, and validated. So that would be what FDA considers to be a lab-developed test. And currently, there is a different regulatory threshold for lab-developed tests than FDA-reviewed tests. So people in the sort of FDA-regulated community would claim that there's an unlevel playing field and non-parity involved. So lab-developed tests do not undergo pre-market review. They're often used on patients while the lab is still investigating clinical utility. We'll often see press releases where a lab might announce the launch of a new lab-developed test, and then the next week they actually announce the beginning of the clinical trial intended to assess that test performance. So in that case, we would consider that test to be investigational, but yet those patients are not offered informed consent for that test being used on them. So there's a problem with enforcement discretion there. Also, CLIA, there is no requirement for clinical...
Why isn't that? Can you just explain why that isn't a research question?
Why?
You said they often don't have informed consent.
Right.
Why
so,
not?
So somebody, a lab at this point may offer a test that is still basically that they're still investigating the clinical performance of that test. But right now, under enforcement discretion, there's no way of keeping them from doing that. So these tests are sometimes, and there are different labs. Obviously, there's responsible labs that may not choose to do this, but there may be labs who may choose to do this. They'll offer a test before it's been fully studied. But the patient isn't informed that the test is still being studied. That was the point I meant to make. Does that make sense?
It makes as much sense as it does.
Right.
Right.
FDA believes that's a problem we're concerned about. Under CLIA, CMS, there's no requirement for clinical validity. So the lab processes that CLIA looks at are really processes for assuring analytic validity and basically that they can perform a test and get an analytically correct result. There is no requirement for that clinical validity step I mentioned earlier. Labs vary greatly. There are really great labs that do put a lot of effort into test validity and might make different choices. There are other labs who perhaps maybe don't have the expertise in-house that they might need to correctly validate a test. So it varies from lab to lab. Under CLIA, there are no post-marketing surveillance or recall requirements. So I don't know if some of you are aware, a couple years ago there was an issue where Quest actually had a vitamin D test that was a lab-developed test, and they had been performing this test for a couple of years, and they actually had to send out a retraction letter. They don't really offer the same sorts of recourses or investigation that an FDA recall would, or a safety compliance or surveillance program. Companies that come in and get FDA approval for perhaps a cystic fibrosis test have a higher bar than a laboratory who might create that same test in their own laboratory. And certainly with FDA making noise in this area, there's a lot of risk, and laboratories are confused. And so they really want to know what is FDA going to do, or is CMS going to do, or what is the government going to do in terms of regulating us. So here's where I'll try and address, you know, if there are all these problems, why did FDA do this to begin with? And really, the reality there is that lab-developed tests now are not the same as lab-developed tests when this practice started. So this particular policy was never one that was actually written down. It was never one that was expressly decided on. The fact is, it was actually FDA started regulating tests in 1976, and at that point in time, this was where a doctor went down the hall to their pathologist and said, you know, I have this patient, and I really need this test. Can you help me out? And then they used well-established methodologies on local, regional populations to do this. Now we have a case where we have the internet, we have aggressive marketing by companies who have set themselves up for labs, and with molecular diagnostics, we have very complex technologies that are being used, often very proprietary technologies, that are being used by laboratories and offered very widely for population screening and more high-risk type intended uses. So I think the playing field today is not the same as it was when this practice started, and the questions that I'm going to get to in a minute is, you know, what is the right thing to do at this point in time? So, like I said before, FDA has authority over medical devices, and a lab-developed test is a medical device. If a lab makes a lab-developed test, then they are actually a medical device manufacturer, technically. FDA has applied enforcement discretion over most lab-developed tests. And I think one common misunderstanding is if you have a CLIA certificate, you can do basically whatever you want. But that actually isn't true. So the policy of FDA enforcement discretion has not yet changed, but it certainly could. And in the meantime, FDA regulates by risk. And what we're really concerned about is when patients are put at risk. So we're going to be making decisions on enforcement at this current time based on risk. So, you know, if we see a test where we think patients are at risk, we may take action. So I think there's a lot of public health and policy decisions to be made, but FDA doesn't intend to do that in the secret. We actually intend to get a lot of input from people and figure out what is the right thing to do in this area. So anything that FDA decides to do shouldn't be a complete surprise to people. So one thing that's kind of confusing is I talked about what is a lab-developed test. I think one thing that's confusing people is what is not a lab-developed test. And I think some of these practices are fairly widespread, so FDA wants to get the word out a little bit that some of these practices would not put them under FDA enforcement discretion. If you have a laboratory that has multiple sites, CMS actually requires individual certificates for each site, and that would make them each individual labs. So distribution of a test between sites in one company would be distribution of a test and not a lab-developed test. Contract manufactured tests. So if you're a laboratory and you just don't feel like doing all of the test manufacturing steps for your test and you want to contract that out, that's no longer a lab-developed test. That's a test that's manufactured and sold to one customer. Custom manufactured devices. Often this could be true for microarrays. That's one example of a custom manufactured device where a laboratory goes online and they order a microarray for their test and they put in the custom oligos they want to put on that oligo. But they're not manufacturing that array. That actually would not be a lab-developed test. Tests obtained through agreements or purchase from others. So somebody else has developed a test and the lab decides, you know what, I think I'm going to offer that here. That's also not a lab-developed test. And things that actually aren't laboratory services. So if you get test results from another lab, but all you do is run the software you developed and provide test results, then you are a medical device manufacturer who's offering a medical test, and that test is not a lab-developed test. So this discussion is fairly broad. Many of you may be aware the late Senator Kennedy actually introduced a bill in 2007 which would have provided for FDA regulation of all lab-developed tests. That bill didn't get very far. I've not heard anything about that concept being reintroduced. A company called Genentech has actually sent in a petition to FDA to ask FDA to regulate all lab-developed tests. FDA is considering that petition, and we have not responded. There are several proposals that are out there. The Hopkins Genetic and Public Policy Center several months ago came out with their proposal for how genetic tests in particular, but really lab-developed tests, should be addressed. And also AdvaMed has come up with their own proposal for what they call risk-based regulation of tests. In a nutshell, that would be basically FDA regulation of all tests regardless of business model. The American Clinical Laboratory Association advocates stronger CMS regulation of lab-developed tests where more regulation is needed in lieu of FDA regulation of tests. And the Coalition for 21st Century Medicine sort of has a hybrid of the two. The previous administration's Secretary's Advisory Committee for Genetics, Health, and Society made one recommendation in their report that FDA should address using their risk-based methods all laboratory tests, including lab-developed tests. But, you know, with all these proposals, and there are more than this, there's still nothing that's really been decided in terms, but there's a lot of discussion, meetings like this and meetings like other ones. But I think all people are sort of wondering, you know, should tests be regulated by risk rather than business model? Really, what makes sense for public health? So the things that we're struggling with in terms of challenges is what is the proper level of federal oversights for lab-developed tests, or I guess that's why maybe that's why you asked us to talk today. But I think maybe a more basic question is, you know, what's the level of clinical evidence for new tests that would assure not only FDA approval, even if you didn't have that, would assure adoption, but also patient safety? And I think what, you know, companies and laboratories might care about as well is payer reimbursement. The bar for payer reimbursement for genetic tests is actually quite high. Some of the MedCAC meetings that have gone on recently, the decisions have not been in favor of reimbursement over the across the board for genetic tests. So there is some skepticism on clinical applicability. So the question is, you know, we can test, we can measure molecular entities, we can measure these genes, but should we test? Is there a clinical reason? Do we have enough information to interpret them? And then what FDA works at every day is how do we balance being able to innovate and create new technologies and get new tests out there to patients with assuring the safety of those patients, with making sure they have informed consent where there's not enough information known about the test, or where assuring that the test is safe and effective for them. So the bad news is, you know, I think when we talk about this clinical evaluation of these genetic type tests, there's a lot of biology that's not known. There's a lot of clinical applicability that's not known. There's financial uncertainties for these companies, especially if they don't know how they may be regulated in the future. But the good news is, at least at FDA, we do have a lot of resources, and we have a lot of ways people can come talk to us. So I have the words pre-IDE up here. Really what that is a mechanism for people to come to FDA and talk to us informally about their product. They can come in and say, you know what, I have this test, and thinking of doing this clinical study, thinking of this protocol for this use, what do you think? And FDA will actually provide feedback, we'll meet with you, we'll talk to companies about potential applications or regulatory requirements for them. And we have some new resources. We've actually recently created a new personalized medicine staff within our office. We've gotten 20 new people that we're able to hire, and we've got a new director for this personalized medicine initiative. Some of you may know Dr. Elizabeth Mansfield. She'll be heading that group.
What is MDUFA?
MDUFA is user fees. So for a test that comes in to FDA, the company actually pays for FDA review. So for a 510K, it's a few thousand dollars. For a PMA, it's quite a bit more. So we get resources for that to shorten the timelines and make it sort of a little bit easier for us to review tests. So here's where I take your questions. And then if you have questions that you don't think of today, you can certainly email me at any point in time, and I'd be really happy to get back to you. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions? David.
Dr. Harper, that was very informative. We've kind of been waiting all day yesterday for the FDA to tell us what really happens at the agency. The issue I think that concerns, one of the issues that came up yesterday has to do with the reliability of the performance mm-hmm. of a test. And I don't believe, I mean, my understanding is that neither CLIA nor CMS are really doing that. And certainly from kinds of lab inspections that I went through when I was the director of pathology, they were all, you know, checklists and processes and other thermometers that calibrated and this kind of thing. So in most hospital settings, there is self-elected accreditation that involves proficiency testing. Mm-hmm. Proficiency testing is really the only check for anybody on the ability of that laboratory to mm-hmm. conduct and report accurately a particular kind of a test. We don't really know whether the commercial sector engages in any of the national proficiency testing options that are out there. Do you?
So I'll back up a little and I say, you know, I want to say I agree with you in terms of the scope of CMS review of laboratories. And I have to say they do a very good job at what they do. But it's actually not within their scope to go to these tests and look at analytical performance. I will say that maybe to some people's chagrin, we work very closely with CMS, and GDO's group sometimes actually sends us the data to look at informally. And I have to say that we haven't been very impressed with a lot of the data that we get from clinical laboratories in terms of analytical performance. So that's one thing that I think makes us a little bit more concerned. The second point with proficiency testing is one of the challenges I think that's been discussed quite a bit, especially in genetics, is the lack of proficiency testing materials and the lack of a CMS-mandated proficiency testing program for genetics. And I think CMS is open to expanding that program, but that takes some time. In the meantime, most labs, as you know, they tend to try and switch samples. They tend to try to basically create their own proficiency testing program because it actually is mandated that they do some sort of proficiency testing. The challenge for some of these direct-to-consumer genome tests is actually there's no other test like them. So you can't switch samples with other labs and sort of get some independent type evaluation. My understanding is some of these labs actually do try and do some proficiency testing, but it's usually an internal variety where they'll use a sample, a blinded sample that they've done before or something like that. But that's really only checking that what they're doing today is the same as what they did last week, not what they did, whether what they did last week was actually correct. So that there's a little bit of challenge there, and actually I'm not sure whether there's a good solution to that when you have, in terms of proficiency testing, when you have these tests that aren't standardized, so you don't have something that you could test on this lab and get the same result as this lab. So I agree, that's a big challenge. And I think one where, you know, especially the Genetics and Public Policy Center has been calling for sort of more requirements for proficiency testing for genetics. But I don't have a solution for you. I think we share your concern.
Thank you. My question relates to your discussion of the possibility of doing a risk-based analysis and whether historically or now there's been a discussion of the scope of what risks FDA looks at and whether that's flexible, can change over time, whether it depends on the technology or the issue involved, and how you sort of work through those questions.
Yeah, FDA's assessment of risk is one of the things I think it's hardest to explain, but I have to say it's something we do every day. So we really get a sense of it. In terms of what risk we look at the gamut. So we have things that are low risk, we have things that are very high risk, and we basically have to make the assessment the way that I talked about. What are the consequences if that, in terms of IVDs, if that test is wrong? You know, can somebody, so HIV is the most obvious example. If you get a false negative result, that person goes out and perhaps spreads the disease, which is a public health nightmare. That test is a high risk test. Whereas a pregnancy test is a moderate risk test because obviously there are some interventions that might interfere with the health of the mother or the baby, but you know, if your test is wrong, you have a false negative, you're going to find out eventually that you're pregnant. So you know, we take the clinical paradigm, we really look at risk that way. In terms of whether they change, yes, sometimes they do. So technology is not the only sort of determination of risk. So something, just because it's in a new technology, or maybe it's a microarray, or maybe it's a something FDA has never seen before, does not automatically make that thing high risk. It's really the intended use. If you were to use a brand new type of measuring technique or technology to look at athlete's foot, FDA would not consider that to be probably very high risk. Whereas if you were to use a standard ELISA test for something that the consequences were high, it could be high risk. So technology isn't the only determination, and they can change as the clinical community and FDA understands more about the risks. FDA can also down-classify or up-classify by risk.
Go ahead from the back. We'll just keep going in turn.
Okay, Faye Szymanski. I'm with the College of American Pathologists, and I just have one comment and one question. The first comment was on the slide about the parity between CLIA tests that go through the CLIA approval, or rather laboratories that go through the CLIA approval process, and manufacturers who go through FDA, and the focus is very much on them, the fact that manufacturers have to meet the requirements of FDA, but there's also a lot of requirements in CLIA that laboratories are meeting that manufacturers don't have to address to. And my other question was on your slide about laboratory-developed tests. You had a comment about laboratory-developed tests being marketed while clinical utility was still being investigated. And it's my understanding that that's true of FDA cleared or approved tests too, that FDA looks at clinical validity, but it does not look at clinical utility. Is that correct?
We look at what they claim. So often that would be clinical validity. So like I said, if they claim that the test is 1 year mortality or 1 year mortality from cardiovascular disease, then we look at that data. So that would be clinical validity. Whether or not that actually helps in the outcome of the patient, whether you do that test, is not something we look at unless they claim it. So if we make that distinction between clinical validity and clinical utility, that is true that FDA does not do that. So we're very claims-based. But we do look at clinical information supporting the intended use. So perhaps I should have said that.
Sharon?
I wonder if you could address a little bit more this dual pathway for development of tests and marketing, and particularly the uncertainty and the complexity of all this and the risks that I think that poses, for example, for dual approval in this era of targeted therapies for a companion diagnostic and a test. Because if we're ever going to achieve the promise of personalized medicine, we're going to have a clearer pathway to get there. And it's very unclear right now, and it's causing a lot of, I think, stifling and uncertainty in the business community for drug developers and test developers who happen usually to be different people, different companies. And so I don't understand, and maybe you can explain, when you had that long list of recommendations and discussions, the Secretary's Committee, the Genentech petitions proposal, the whole thing. What's your process? How are you going to get to a point where you're going to make a decision? Because it's like all this pent up waiting for decisions to clarify this. And I understand you're being very careful, and I'm very pleased to see there's a new Office of Personalized Medicine that Dr. Mansfield is going to head. But this is like, what's going to be the pathway by which you are going to get to clarity in this area?
Certainly, I understand your frustration, and it's one that we have to deal with in a lot of areas. Now, one thing, I actually can provide a little clarity on one of the things you mentioned, which is companion diagnostics. FDA actually has been saying fairly consistently, and maybe we haven't been saying it loudly or clearly enough, that when a diagnostic test is required for drug use, so something along the lines of HER2 or EGFR, and is in the label saying you need to do this test before you give that drug for safety or efficacy. Even when there are lab-developed tests, FDA is requiring that that test be approved. So I'd like to be clear on that point right now. That's something that I can answer outright. It's the other lab-developed test that we have not expressed clear policies on, and I understand how frustrating that is. The slide where I sort of said this shouldn't be a discussion behind closed doors is a little bit misleading in that some of it has to be behind closed doors, where we're not allowed to disclose public non-public information. But what I do mean is FDA would like to engage in public discussion. We do like to come to these sorts of meetings. FDA might entertain the option of having a public meeting for discussing this area. Meetings like this where we attend, we think are useful in terms of getting input from the public. And you can always provide comments to the dockets, or you can provide your opinion. That's not as satisfying in terms of a back and forth. Our mechanisms are limited. Our mechanisms are things like guidance documents, proposed rulemaking, and regulatory approvals that somehow give information. Those are somewhat the mechanisms by which we can provide information. And unfortunately, the process for getting out things like that isn't fast. So let me assure you we're working on it. We welcome input, and we'd love the chance to discuss any of that, what we can discuss in forums like this. I'm sure that's not satisfying.
I'm Joan Scott from the Genetics and Public Policy Center, and one of the sort of the end results of this sort of two-layered system or two pathways is that the end user, that being the consumer in the direct-to-consumer market or the clinician in the traditional testing way, don't know. And so they're getting a test and they don't know what sort of regulatory hurdles or not any test has gone through, or the performance of the laboratory itself, because that's a lot of that is cloaked in, let's just say that. So we have called for, and other groups like the Secretary Advisory Committee on Genetics, Health and Society has called for, a registry as being one mechanism to make some of this more transparent to the end user. Do you have any, does the FDA have any comments or thoughts about the use of a test registry to at least get what information is known about the tests and the laboratories performing the tests out there?
I don't have any official comments on any plans for a registry. Certainly we are aware of those recommendations, and I think that at the technical level, the groups don't think registry is a bad idea for the reasons you mentioned. You can get an idea of what's out there. It can be a little bit more transparent in terms of what you're dealing with and who's offering what and all of that. But in terms of actual decisions that can be announced, I'm afraid I don't have any of that.
Hi, just when you've mentioned already a couple of times of the problems with the LDT, enforcement discretion and whatnot, but with the addition of the 20 new staff in the personalized medicine office and just looking particularly at IVDs, I mean, is FDA really though stepping up enforcement in the sense of looking at this? Because it sounds like you realize that there are these issues here, and it sounds as if maybe it's my own extrapolation, but FDA may be doing something more about it than it has in the past, and I just want to know if that's...
We definitely are talking about it more. I mean, we have things in front of us that we are basically being asked to answer, so we will have to do that. In terms of whether or not we will up enforcement, like I said, right now we're saying we're going to do that by risk, and if we decide to do otherwise, we'd like to do that in as transparent a manner as possible.
But has it always been done according to risk, or is that a new policy?
No, I mean, FDA is always regulated.
Right, and that's, okay.
But certainly I think we're just being more concerned about this area, and
okay.
We have taken some action so far against lab-developed tests where we thought that there were risks to patients.
Okay, thank you.
Partha Paul from Interleukin Genetics. I was wondering, maybe you have not covered it in your talk here, but how do you distinguish and differentiate between LDT and class 1 devices, and do you have any specific example where you have looked at a genetic test as a class 1 device?
So class 1 is kind of not related to whether it's an LDT or not. Class 1 is related to the intended use. So a product that's class 1 really has a very low risk to patients if the test result is wrong. So I think they're not that related. In terms of genetic tests that are class 1, we haven't seen any so far that have been classified in that manner. Could there be one? Certainly. And it would have to be for something where the impact is low, where the claims are very low. But what they are, I can't list because we don't have any classified at this point.
Thank you.
Tim? Hey, Courtney. Jennifer Lieb with Health Futures. Just one quick clarification question and one longer question. First, when you just said that you are requiring companion diagnostics to be cleared by FDA, is that 510K or PMA?
They're usually going to be PMAs when they're linked to
drugs. With the drug. Okay. And then when one of the things you mentioned where it's a really difficult challenge for manufacturers of tests and even LDT tests to figure out, to figure out their business plan 2 to 3 years down the road, even 5 years down the road, based on all the changing factors at FDA. And one of the big issues that came up in the last few years, it seems to have been really quiet in the last few months, is the IVD MIA guidance. And I was wondering, you know, that's a great example of what you were saying with FDA trying to carve out risk-based groups of tests or groups of tests based on risk for clearance. And I'm wondering if that's what happened to that guidance. Should we anticipate that in the near future?
Things really happened to it. It didn't finalize before the last administration. So FDA is still working on it, but it's just a matter of the administration change, actually, and getting new people in place. That's really like not allowed a lot of policy decisions, not just that one, to go forward.
Tim?
Well, it just comes back to the question of risk and direct-to-consumer tests, really. And clearly with HIV, there's no question everyone would agree that there's a risk, a high risk of damage if those tests are reported wrongly. But I think in the IVDD directive in the European Union, the view has been, well, spitting into a tube and sending off your DNA to a company doesn't constitute any risk to the consumer, but the risk comes in when the result comes back, whether there's any potential risk of misinterpretation or damage in terms of future lifestyle or medical decisions. And so on that basis, that's why the UK Human Genetics Commission has recommended that these types of tests should not be in the lowest risk category. And I just wondered if the FDA had considered that aspect of risk for direct-to-consumer tests.
I think we think along those lines. We take a little bit of a different route to get there. We consider the whole test, but we go by intended use, which is what I think that you mean, which is, you know, what are you claiming that the test result provides? And so it really will depend on the individual claims. You know, we have a case that we might be concerned about. Say somebody is on warfarin and they get one of these, and then it says to them that they are at increased risk of warfarin sensitivity or they should reduce their dose. Someone doing that without going to their doctor can put themselves at a pretty high risk. So there's a case where there is risk involved in that result being misused or misinterpreted by the individual. And then you have certainly BRCA1 and BRCA2 testing now being offered directly to consumers. And certainly that has its own risk in terms of understanding, is that test right for me, type of thing. So we would look at the individual uses in a similar manner.
Dr. Harper, one other thing. In terms of the commercial sector, could you please help us understand the way the FTC and the FDA interact on these things?
We do interact with the FTC, not often, but in cases where it's applicable, they will sometimes send us things for scientific consult. They don't have their own scientists in-house that actually could look at this type of thing. So if they had a question about claims and the science behind it, they might send us data to look at. That has happened. We might refer a case to them if we thought that it was an FTC-type case and not a medical device case. So, for example, there are some genetic tests offered to consumers that FDA would not regulate as a medical device, the ancestry testing generally, eye color, things like that, that may not have a medical claim. FDA may not intend to regulate ever. If we thought that there was an issue there, we might refer that to FTC. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen.
Would it be possible just to have one brief comment?
Briefly, David.
Thank you very much. I would just like to redress Dr. Korn's statement about proficiency testing or question. We're certainly engaged. It's my understanding that CLIA requires proficiency testing. And in the case of custom tests, there is an alternative assessment. Mm-hmm. And our laboratory is engaged in proficiency testing with an outside CLIA-approved laboratory. The limitation comes when you can't share with hundreds of laboratories your test and common samples. But we do reach out to another laboratory and do those testings. We would actually welcome kind of a registry and an open analysis of that kind of result across these kinds of tests.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Courtney, for joining us today. I think we're going to have to move on.
This is very quick.
I do appreciate.
It's very quick. Could you give us the status of the co-development guidance?
It's still being worked on. Unfortunately, I can't predict that it will be done anytime soon.
Well, we here too are in a work in progress, and we're